Greetings and welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll take a look back at the Summit of the Americas held in Santiago, Chile. The 34 countries present at the summit agreed to a timetable of meetings meant to establish a free trade area of the Americas by 2005. They also pledged to take steps to deal with the region's social ills, such as poor education, lack of health services, and rising levels of poverty. We'll talk about what these developments really mean for the people of Latin America. Later, we'll have an in-depth analysis of United States policy in Colombia. In early April, a major conference was held in Washington, D.C. about Colombia. We'll play some highlights of the conference and see how the U.S. may be making things worse in an already difficult situation. All of this and more coming up next, but first here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news for Our Americas, I'm Laura Tarantini. Sarah Gill is on vacation this week.
And I'm Walter Krugman. Puerto Rican Governor Pedro Rosselló is not taking no for an answer. The governor flew to Washington April 22nd to lobby Congress in favor of the recently defeated Young Bill for a U.S.-sponsored plebiscite on the island's status. Although the bill was approved in the House of Representatives last month by a one-vote margin, it is in danger of stalling in the Senate before the 1997-1998 term ends. The plebiscite he is lobbying for would allow Puerto Ricans to choose among statehood, independence, or the current semi-autonomous Commonwealth status. Under the present Commonwealth status, Puerto Ricans pay local income tax instead of federal tax, are subject to all military drafts, and have no vote in Congress or in U.S. presidential elections. Under the bill's provisions, however, the U.S. Congress would still have to give final approval to independence or statehood. Rosselló was quoted as saying that it's a contradiction that the U.S. assails Cuba for its undemocratic ways, while it keeps the 3.8 million U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico disenfranchised.
In Peru, the army and the Tupac Amaru rebels are each commemorating their dead on the anniversary of the bloody end the army put to the four-month rebel siege of the Japanese ambassador's residence. President Alberto Fujimori paid homage in a ceremony en masse to the two soldiers who died when 140 trained commandos counterattacked the ambassador's residence, freeing all but one hostage who was killed and slaughtering all the 14 rebels inside. In a communique to mark the anniversary, the Tupac Amaru guerrilla movement, or MRTA, announced a hunger strike among its political prisoners to remember its fallen comrades and said the storming of the residence last April had brought the lack of democracy in Peru and its increasing poverty to the world's attention. The MRTA also repeated its accusation that Peruvian troops captured and executed some rebels during the counterstrike. With testimony from a former hostage, a raiding commando, police and intelligence sources indicating the claim could be true, human rights organizations have asked for an investigation. Fujimori has flatly denied the charges and has ignored the calls.
For the first time in Guatemala's history, a group of soldiers is being tried for a massacre. They are charged with killing 11 indigenous peasants towards the end of the country's 36-year civil war, which claimed 140,000 lives. The so-called Chaman Massacre, named after the farm where it occurred on October 5, 1996, almost derailed government guerrilla peace talks aimed at ending the decades-long civil war. The 11 peasants massacred had belonged to a group of exiled refugees that returned during the peace process to found a town in the northern province of Alta Verapaz. Witnesses to the killing said that an army patrol of 24 soldiers were ordered by their commanding officer to fire on the unarmed townspeople after an argument over whether the soldiers could bring guns into a community party broke out. The event made many despair that the army had returned to its scorched-earth counterinsurgency campaign, but the peace talks continued, resulting in the accords signed in 1997 and the end of the war. The trial, held 125 miles northeast of Guatemala's capital, is expected to proceed without the threats of violence of the past.
The U.S. is fuming after it failed for the first time since 1991 to persuade the U.N. Human Rights Commission to condemn Cuba for rights violations. The 53-member commission voted by 19-16 against the U.S.'s motion that the island nation undergo 1 year's renewed investigation. Some 18 countries abstained from the vote.
On April 16th, after a long hiatus of 30 years, the Dominican Republic and Cuba restored full diplomatic relations. Dominican President Leonel Fernandez announced at the Summit of the Americas that he would invite President Fidel Castro to a meeting of Caribbean leaders in Santo Domingo in August. If Castro takes up the invitation, it will be his first visit to the Dominican Republic. The move has created a stir among Cuban-American leaders who claim that the decision is insensitive to the plight of Cubans on the island. Relations between Cuba and the Dominican Republic were broken off after Cuba was expelled from the Organization of American States following the 1959 revolution.
And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week. For Our Americas, I'm Laura Tarantini.
And I'm Walter Krokmo.
You're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In other news, there were a number of developments regarding U.S.-Cuba policy over the past week. In a startling defeat for the United States, the U.N. Human Rights Commission in Geneva on April 21st rejected a U.S.-sponsored proposal calling for a U.N. Special Rapporteur on Human Rights to investigate Cuba. The commission also rejected a U.S. resolution seeking to condemn the island nation for human rights abuses. This was the first defeat at the commission for the U.S. regarding Cuba since 1991. On that same day, the European Union, meanwhile, dropped its case against the U.S. Helms-Burton law before the World Trade Organization. Many European nations say the act violates international law. Our America's Jeremy Scahill talked with the first chief of the U.S. intersection, Wayne Smith, about these recent developments regarding Cuba. He first asked him how significant was the defeat for the U.S. before the U.N. Human Rights Commission in Geneva.
Well, it's a major defeat for U.S. diplomacy and a rejection of U.S. policy, another rejection of U.S. policy on the part of the international community. I don't think it indicates a lack of concern on the part of the commission or the international community, for that matter, with respect to the situation of human rights in Cuba. There are violations of human rights in Cuba. We recognize that. But it is a rejection of the U.S. approach. And I think increasingly the international community is unwilling to follow the U.S. lead on Cuba. Our policy simply doesn't work, and everyone sees it.
Talk about how the United States government has historically used human rights to justify its policy toward Cuba.
Well, the United States always accuses Cuba of being a violator of human rights. It is. It does violate human rights. There are very few countries that don't have some violations of human rights. But the fact of the matter is that Cuba's record is excellent in comparison with a number of other countries with which the United States has excellent relations. Let's take Indonesia, for example. Indonesia's record on human rights is appalling. It's far worse than Cuba's, and Indonesia certainly is not a democracy. And yet we have a very fulsome relationship with Indonesia. We're helping to bail out their economy. And as we know, apparently some Indonesians have contributed to U.S. campaign funds. And then there's China, Saudi Arabia, on and on. I mean, look, there are more violations of human rights in Peru and a number of other Latin American countries than there are in Cuba. So it is perceived, our use of human rights to beat Cuba over the head is perceived as a rather hypocritical move on the part of the United States, and one dictated by internal politics, that we're simply playing to the hardline exiles in the right wing of the Republican Party, that it's not a matter of principle. It's not that we're really that concerned over human rights in Cuba. It's a matter of domestic politics.
The United States State Department issues reports on human rights for various countries around the world. And in the report on Cuba, the State Department has referred to Cuba as the Western Hemisphere's greatest violator of human rights. How credible are these reports done by the State Department?
Well, it's an absolutely absurd assertion. There are violations of human rights in Cuba. People are arrested for expressing views against the government and so forth. But no one is being disappeared and tortured and that kind of thing. I mean, there are far worse violations of human rights in Peru, and as we've seen recently on the part of the Mexican government in Chiapas, than in Cuba. As other countries look at the inconsistency of our position, it becomes apparent to them we're simply using the issue of human rights to beat Cuba over the head in an effort to curry favor or votes or money from the hardline exiles in Miami and to placate the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. In other words, it has to do with domestic politics, not a matter of principle. Doesn't reflect any sincere concern over human rights. It's simply a political instrument. And I think the commission in Geneva has now recognized that and rejected our resolution. This is simply the latest in a series of rebuffs and defeats for U.S. policy toward Cuba. No one agrees with our approach to Cuba.
Now, the UN General Assembly has voted consistently to condemn U.S. policy toward Cuba, and I believe that the most recent vote was one of the largest condemnations of U.S. policy toward Cuba in history, if not the largest. You had fewer nations abstaining than ever before. Why has the UN Commission on Human Rights been different than the General Assembly as regards U.S. policy toward Cuba?
Well, look, the General Assembly has voted time after time to condemn the U.S. embargo against Cuba. The UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva is charged with looking at the situation of human rights. And there are some violations of human rights, but I think the report every year has been reasonably balanced. They have pointed out that, yes, there are violations of human rights in Cuba, but they have also pointed out that the U.S. embargo, in fact, contributes to the situation, makes it worse, and that it itself violates the human rights of the Cuban people. So I think you have two separate issues here, and the UN Human Rights Commission has now come around to saying we don't accept the approach of the United States. A resolution that is identified with the United States will not be accepted in this body.
Our guest is Wayne Smith. He's the former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Cuba. Wayne Smith, the European Union is dropping its case, at least for the time being, against the Helms-Burton Act before the World Trade Organization. Why do you think that the countries of the European Union decided to do this?
Well, there's a truce. I think what you have here is a running truce. They don't say that. They talk about continuing to negotiate. But in fact, what's happened is that the European Union has said, okay, we will not go ahead with our protest so long as the United States does not implement the Helms-Burton bill against European companies, so long as you do not implement Title III, taking companies to court, or Title IV, denying visas to European businessmen. If you implement, if you deny one visa, then we will go ahead with the protest. So the idea that they've dropped it and we're trying to negotiate differences is just camouflage. That's just the face they're putting forward to the world.
Now, it seems to be that part of the trend as regards the European community regarding Cuba is that they're wanting to engage Cuba by making humanitarian aid packages contingent upon business deals. Do you think that this eventually is the direction that U.S. policy will take?
No, I would hope not. I don't think that's the way to go. I certainly support humanitarian donations to Cuba, but I think we should keep humanitarian donations distinct from business.
Wayne Smith was the first chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Cuba. He was speaking with Our America's Jeremy Scahill. Yet another summit of the Americas is now history, with leaders of 34 countries setting in motion a process to establish the world's largest free trade zone. The three-day meeting in Santiago wrapped up on April 19th with considerable optimism over the joint action plan that was laid out, meant to set an agenda for trade talks and establish working groups for special areas of concern. Their ultimate goal, of course, is the free trade area of the Americas to be up and running by 2005. President Bill Clinton tried to downplay the internal political resistance to the idea during the summit and instead emphasized the new relationships being strengthened throughout the hemisphere, relationships which he says have changed considerably since the region emerged from the dark era of military dictatorships. Joining us now to help us make sense of what really happened in Santiago during the Summit of the Americas is Dr. James Petras, a professor of Latin American politics at the State University of New York at Binghamton. Dr. Petras is the author of numerous books on Latin America, the most recent being Neoliberalism and Class Conflict in Latin America, published by Macmillan Press. James Petras, I don't know, maybe copies of your latest book should have been made available to the leaders of the summit who were in Chile last week, because there seems to be some major contradictions coming out of their pronouncements. For example, we can just quickly read their final communique, which they say, quote, "We're confident the free trade area of the Americas will improve the well-being of all our people, including economically disadvantaged populations within our own respective countries," unquote. James Petras, how do you suppose they intend to do this?
Well, I think there's a recognition that the free market has been a disaster for the majority of the people, at least Clinton's public presentation. But I think the mechanisms they're using to extend the market have no built-in power base through which any of the potential growth could be redistributed downward. In fact, the very nature of the summit emphasizes the way in which this whole process of economic free market has been centralized in the presidencies and bypassed any public consultation. Sort of highlights the continuation of this highly concentrated wealth at the top and the meager benefits at the bottom. I think the very people that are discussing the free market are precisely the people who have taken the measures that have created this very unequal development, probably the worst period in recent history of Latin America in terms of income distribution and the growth of a massive sector of impoverished people. So it's like millionaires discussing how to get rich and then throwing in a bone about social development, education, and what I think is really interesting in all of this, whoever Clinton's speechwriter is, referred to these as nominal democracies. Now that is something to flag, because a lot of the academics in the United States and Latin America keep talking about the transition to democracy following the lead in the New York Times. But the fact is that they're nominal because there is no substantive policies that reflect majoritarian interest. That's the first thing. And they're nominal because, as Clinton recognizes, there's been virtually no benefits from decisions made by their officials. And thirdly, it's a recognition of the tremendous popular frustration that's building up underneath this apparent consensus on the free market. So I think Clinton is flagging an issue as a kind of fireman here, that some attempt should be made, even symbolic, to make concessions.
Well, let me ask you, James Petras, because you brought up a lot of points which I indeed want to touch on, the issue of democracy, also the issue of at least giving lip service. And it seems like in this summit, there were a number of the summit leaders embraced a number of so-called action items that they wanted to deal with to address the inequalities that some of these policies have led to, issues of education, the environment, fighting poverty, and other things like that. But the environment in which this summit was held is interesting, because it was held in Santiago de Chile, in a country that was formerly a military dictatorship, which now is being touted as, well, now they've made the transition to democracy, and it's also an economic example for the rest of the region. He made his speech, President Clinton, within a joint session of Chile's Congress, where there was one notable person who was not present at the Congress, and that is Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile, who is now a senator for life. Can you tell us what's your sense about how that whole thing took place, and maybe the speech writing of President Clinton, and what his sense, where he was coming from with that presentation?
Well, I think Chile is the most flagrant case in which you have an electoral system cohabitating with military power. When Pinochet named his commander-in-chief, essentially, or put a veto on any choices that President Frei had, when he ordered Frey to keep his nose out of the promotions and structure of military organization, the public budget, you got a real sense of a very limited civilian power dealing with the continuation of the military as a important power broker. This isn't the pocket of authoritarianism. This is an institution that wields enormous control in Chile, and I think everybody recognizes it, even as the Chilean political class is very embarrassed as they go parading across the world, flaunting their success story. I think that's one part of it. I think the reference to nominal democracies that Clinton made certainly applies to Chile. There have been numerous instances over the last several years of Pinochet inserting himself into political debates, rattling the sabers, and intimidating the politicians to the point that his ascendancy to a lifetime senator was accepted by the Socialist Party leadership, the Christian Democratic Party leadership, even as some dissidents made some dissonant noises. Now, beyond that, I think, is the Chilean social situation. And that is a social situation in which you have the greatest inequalities in Chilean history. And I think we should recognize that as part of the model. And I think we need to look at the fact that while the official poverty figures are declining from something like 44%, 7 years ago to about 28% today, they leave out of account the fact that these poverty lines are very relative, that many of the Chilenos who've gotten employment are working in marginal jobs in the sense of their pay scales, that their multiple family members that are working to maintain a semblance of a standard of living, that the Chilean society is one of the most segregated socially of any place I've been in the world, with the most elegant kind of Beverly Hills settings, multi-million dollar castles for the rich, very pleasant surroundings for the upper middle class, and squalid squatter settlements, highly policed by the police, Carabineros, the federal police, on the other side of the tracks. So, if that's what's being touted as a model, I don't think it's very attractive to anyone except the business classes, the investors. And I think this this is the reality of Chile. And despite the public relations campaign, it is, it has been a paradise for investors, foreign investors, mutual funds, but has left out, I would say, over 50% of the population.
We're speaking with Professor James Petras, who teaches Latin American studies at the State University of New York at Binghamton. He's the author of numerous books on Latin American politics, economy, and whatnot from the Caribbean. His latest book is called Neoliberalism and Class Conflict in Latin America, and I think this is the subject of the book is very appropriate for the subject that we're dealing with. James Petras, I just wanted to address another issue, especially in the coverage that was happening during the summit on the Americas. The New York Times, National Public Radio, and other major news outlets, they kept referring to the fact that the U.S. is has a new approach with Latin America, that now President Clinton is dealing with the countries of the region as countries that are among equals. They're no longer talking from the top down, or as geographically looking at it, the north looking down to the south, but more that the United States is dealing with equals, Mexico, Chile, Brazil, etc. What's your sense about this, about the two, about the approach that the United States is taking now with the rest of the region?
Well, I think you have a malleable and accommodating governing class in Latin America that knows what the cues are, has taken the party line to heart, has built a base among its counterparts in Latin America, which are also interested in exports, who are big investors, who have enormous accounts in the United States. These elites are Latin American elites. You'll find them in New York City on Fifth Avenue. You'll find them in Miami in their condos. So I think there is a kind of symbiotic relationship here between the new rich out of the free market in Latin America and their counterparts in the United States, and these are the groups that have essential power within the power structure of Latin America, and they share the same perspective which Clinton has and his cronies in the multinationals and in the banks. So in a sense, since they're on the same wavelength, the same profiteering, the same kind of moving capital around, I think that in that sense, there's not a need to impose policies. It comes from the heart of these transnational Latin American elites, who number several dozen in the billionaire class. And I think we should realize that, and then their camp followers and publicists and their technical advisors, these are all part of the new elite in Latin America that has a, if you want to use this cliche, a global vision and dominate the decision-making process. However, having said all of that, the fact of the matter is that Washington, through its influence in the international financial institutions, still sets the conditions for the financial arrangements and collecting the debt. And it's the U.S. banks that overwhelmingly are holding the debt in Latin America and are collecting interest payments. It's U.S. corporations that are drawing rents on patents, and it's U.S. Investors that are taking more of the profit out of Latin America than the Latin American business class is getting out of the U.S. So I think all of that, plus the trade surpluses that the U.S. has been running up in general with Latin America, point to a very asymmetrical relationship. I think Clinton has mastered the manipulative discourse. It's like he cuts massive programs that affects blacks, and then he organizes civil rights forums and visits black churches and tells them how much he feels for them. When the substantive areas, he's screwing them in every single way, whether it's in terms of public allocations of funds, whether it's in terms of free trade that have decimated heavy industry where blacks are employed. So I think we just have to look at this as a typical Clinton-esque gesture.
Dr. James Petras is a professor of Latin American politics at the State University of New York at Binghamton and the co-author of Neoliberalism and Class Conflict in Latin America. And this is Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. If you want more information about NACLA and their journal report on the Americas, call them at 212-870-3146. That's 870-3146, area code 212. And if you have any questions or comments for us, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.